sure.
First of all, I think it's such a special film for a magnitude of reasons, but I'm kind of curious, what is it about the story that so resonated in you that this became like your mission to see this to fruition?
Yeah. Well, the answer to that is complicated because it changed over time. When I was a little girl, I thought it was just like this huge cosmic adventure. And here was the thing. When I was a little girl, never in my mind had I thought that a daughter could do something a father couldn't. And that just, that was so, talk about empowering, that that she was the one that had to save her brother and not her father. And that also she was the one that apologized to her father for being so angry at him and saying, you know, I wanted you to make everything easy for me. And I now realize I'm the one that has to go back. I think that was a piece of it when I was really young. The other is, I know it sounds crazy, but I felt like I did everything wrong. I had a crush on a red-headed boy in class. We lived in a white house with the woods behind it. And very poignantly, my youngest brother, Tom, had learning disabilities. And so when I read Wrinkle, I really identified with Meg and her relationship with Charles Wallace, and I felt very protective of my younger brother, and that I think I just saw that he was special, like Charles Wallace. So I think those were all of those things. But I think, and then I loved the ladies. I mean, there was every single thing. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, I would dream about what would happen if, like, a perfect stranger came knocking on your door one dark, stormy night and, like, took you away on this adventure? I mean, I just, it all made sense to me. I think the other, too, is I remember reading it, and, you know, when she explains, when Mrs. Watts or Mrs. Who explain the ant on the string and the tesseract, the whole, and Meg says, oh, I got it. Just for a second, I got it. Well, when I was little, I got it. Just for a second, I got it. And so I thought, oh, I'm smart. You know, I think the book made me feel very, very smart. And then, you know, I was so curious because, you know, when they find out that the dark thing has been encircling the earth, in 1963, when I read the book, a lot of really bad things had gone on that year. So the grown-ups around that I was around were very aware of kind of dark times. And so somehow in my young mind, that made perfect sense to me. Like, that is why your planet is such a troubled one. So there were lots of reasons. And then, so when I met Madeline, it was a real learning experience to find out what the whole story meant to her and why she wrote it. And then as she explained it, you know, my understanding really increased. And then and expanded. And then when I became a mother, I saw the entire book from a mother's point of view. You know, so it just goes on and on and on.
How long was it after you first read the book that you revisited the book? I mean, I've read it every year for 52 years, at least once every year.
Wow.
And every time there's a new experience.
Right, exactly.
So I'm curious, after you first read it in 1963, how long was it before you revisited, and how did your thoughts change there?
So, it was 1979, and I was working for a writer-producer named Norman Lear, whom you probably all heard of. And so I was his assistant, which was kind of a different meaning back then. I was really in all of the meetings with him and really helping him kind of create what he was going to do after television, after producing all the TV shows. And a friend of mine asked me, what do I want to produce? And so I gave him A Wrinkle in Time. And he said, wow, this is a cross between Star Wars and The Wizard of Oz. So I asked Norman to read it. And it was in that time that I read it again. And I loved it. You know, my love for it had increased, not decreased. And I thought it was still very timely. And so when Norman read it, he loved it too, but I didn't think it was something for him. And he said, you know, you can go after the rights. I asked if I could go after the rights, and I had to get, of all people, Alan Horn's approval, because he was then president of Norman's company. And so I just loved it then as a young woman. It spoke to me in a completely different way. And so then when I met with Madeline, you know, listening to her talk about the characters, what they all meant to her, it just deepened my commitment to it 1,000-fold. And then it's very strange. I know it's going to sound odd, but there was no internet. I had no idea anybody else had ever read the book. And so I just knew I loved it. You know, I didn't know it was popular. I didn't know it was famous until I met Madeline. And that's when I go, wow. And so over the years, what just really strengthened my resolve to get it made was meeting someone like you, who read it every year for 52 years. I mean, it was like, this is a phenomenon. And then my curiosity would not let up. I thought, how can a book have this kind of an impact on so many different kinds of people? And so I was just determined to make it work.
What is it that you would like, you personally, in, since you produced the movie, that you would like children or even parents to walk away, three things to walk away that they've learned from this?
Gosh, there's so many things. You know, first of all, A Wrinkle in Time is a wonderful story about family. So it's this beautiful relationship between a brother and a sister and a father and a daughter. Also, you know, a friend and the mother with her children and with her husband. But the primary relationships are the brother and sister and the daughter and the father. And Meg does not see the love around her when she starts this journey. And when she comes home, she is able to see the light. She is able to have found the happy medium. She is able to realize how much she loves her brother, who she thought was made her life more difficult, and realize that her father can't solve all of her problems. So I think that's one huge lesson. The other is, Madeline Lango said to me, one of the hardest things any of us ever have to do is to become fully who we are. And I think that is why people resonate so much with the whole thing about faults, that your faults will come in handy here, because being who you are, faults and all, is what you need to be, right? And so I think that's a really important lesson, particularly for young girls. And I think the third is that love is action. And while it is true that it's a very empowering journey for a young girl, you can't lose sight that she did it out of the love for her brother. So it is true, she, you know, was very empowered. You know, she found the courage. She found everything that she needed. But she did it, I think Charles Wallace gave her the courage that she needed to really fight back the darkness. So there's this wonderful blend that, yes, it is true that we need to be true to ourselves, but in context of loving others, that you can do more for someone else than you may be able to do for yourself. And I think that's a third big takeaway from the story.
Thank you.
Did that help you?
Yes, absolutely. Because when we originally saw the movie, I put this down for homeschooling, and my little one's 5, but I read this book to him, you know, 3 pages a night, because we read. So I read it to him, and now every morning what we do because of this book is our 5 things. I am great, I am wanted, I am loved, I am needed, I am. Every morning we say this. Even though he doesn't repeat it, I say it every morning. So I need him to understand that courage is within you. You just need to find it.
Yes, but I hope you add a 6th one.
Tell me.
We love each other. That love is not going to go away. I will always be there. I am in your heart. You keep me in your heart. It is we. I mean, yes, it is. I have the courage, and I have the courage because I love you. You know, so I think you have to keep reinforcing that, because I think right now in the world we live in, we're so focused on our own point of view that we're not seeing the bigger picture. And I hope A Wrinkle in Time will stimulate conversations along those lines.
Thank you.
You mentioned during different life stages you identified with different characters. Which character do you feel like you identify with the most now?
Mrs. Witch. I mean, it's really funny to have read a book when you're so little and you want to play Meg, and now the movie's made and you identify with Vincent's Witch. I did not see that coming. And it's really funny. When I was flying, and I think I mentioned, I was flying to L.A. to meet Jennifer Lee for the first time, and I reread the book because I did have a lot of self-doubt, and I thought, oh, my gosh, what if it's not really good? You know, I was like, I read it again, and I loved it, and I thought, oh, my goodness, this is a story. If you really want to understand A Wrinkle in Time, this is the context in which you should read it. It's Mrs. Witch sitting on a campfire with a lot of new messengers. And one raises her hand and says, what do we do? And she says, well, let me tell you a story about a young girl named Meg Murray. And it all began on a dark and stormy night. And that Mrs. Witch is telling this story. And when I read it, I thought Meg was. And so, yeah. I mean, I thought at one time, I thought, you know, the one time I always identify with Mrs. What's-It, because I like to talk. and I always thought Mrs. What's-It was really funny. And I think also Mrs. What's-It was so honored to be part of this mission. And I always felt very honored to be a part of the effort to bring A Wrinkle in Time to the screen, to know Madeline, all this kind of thing. But now I am the oldest one in the room. So I have grown into Mrs. Witch.
You know, I'm curious on the same, because we form such indelible images of a book when we read it, especially when you read it and revisit it, such as this one. So I'm curious, in the script development stage and working with Jennifer, was there anything that was altered, changed, missing? I know when it was finally done on the big screen, I was in horror. I was like, where's Aunt Beast?
Yeah,
where's
right.
Aunt Beast warming Meg?
Yeah.
So I'm curious if you went through any kind of that emotion.
Well, I have said that. You know, I think Disney's goal was to bring A Wrinkle in Time to the 21st century. And I confess that they dragged me kicking and screaming doing that, because I loved every single thing about the book, and I also knew that things had to be changed for a movie. And, you know, over time, both Jennifer and Ava made me realize that the book was always going to be there. And there is a whole new generation of young people who don't know about the book. And so it was an opportunity to focus in on a very current theme of so much pressure on young girls to be perfect, that A Wrinkle in Time was a wonderful opportunity to be part of this whole mix of young girls and empowerment and all that kind of thing. And I was so proud to be a part of that. And the other piece is that 1 month after the movie was released, A Wrinkle in Time was number one on the USA Today's bestseller list. So when I started to try to remake the movie, you know, I was involved in that TV version, I was so disappointed. And I just it wasn't the dream. And the dream, honestly, was to make sure that this story is brought to a wider audience. So, yes, there are changes in the movie. It was Ava's to change as the director. You know, there was so much written about a young biracial girl, a first black woman director. You know, the thing is, when you are looking for diversity, you're going to have a diverse narrative. You're going to have a new way. You know, not diverse in racial terms so much, but in a just new, you know, a new voice, a new narrative. And so sometimes in the beginning, it's like, oh, it's new. And then it said, yeah, it's new. So I'm very proud that the movie is in the mix when young people are so moved and really, I mean, I love it when Meg is tessering that last tesser and is one with herself and lands. I mean, I've always wanted, I couldn't wait to see that moment in the movie. So, of course, there are things that I wish were in the movie or didn't have to be changed, but the book is there. You know, the book isn't going away. And what's really neat is that if you are missing something from the book, it makes you realize, think about the book. Well, what are you missing? Well, why am I missing that? And I think that's kind of cool, because then you can be thinking about those things that you are missing and think about it, and have, that's never going to go away. It's always there. And this is just a 21st century version of it. Oh, okay.
So, do you feel that people should read the book before they see it, or do you think, like, I'm really excited now, obviously, to read the book, right?
Yeah.
But do you think that it's something that would help people kind of understand the full story, or what's your thoughts on that?
You know, I think, I don't know the answer to it. I'm like the worst person to ask, because I know the book so well.
Right.
In a way, you might want to see the movie first.
Okay.
I think seeing the movie first is probably better, because you may get, you know, wedded to certain things and certain expectations, and then you go, well, where's all of this, right?
Okay.
So and then read the book.
Okay.
And they're two different experiences.
Okay.
Two very different experiences.
Was Ava your first choice for directing the movie, and why did you choose her for it?
I'm sorry, what?
Why was she chosen for
Ava?
Ava, yeah, to direct the movie.
Well, we were looking for who were some of the great directors that were working, and we wanted one of the best directors out there. And I cannot tell a lie. There was a conversation. I know I had it. I almost speak only for myself. Whatever anyone else wants to say. But I had read this article in the New York Times Magazine, and they had interviewed 100 women in the entertainment business, and how difficult it was for women to go from a successful independent feature to a major picture. And everything matters. So that article really got to me, and so I made some phone calls, and you know, everybody else in different places were also thinking about Ava, and I said, you know, this is the heroine's journey. And if there's ever a movie a woman should direct, it is A Wrinkle in Time. And so it was a very short list of women that would be appropriate or even even possible. And Ava was top of our list. So we were really excited when she said yes.
Is there a scene that got cut that wasn't in the movie that you thought, should have been?
Scenes that were filmed and got cut?
Is there anything that just didn't make it to the big screen that you thought should have been in there?
There were scenes that got cut, but they got cut for good reasons.
Okay.
You know, it's not like 20/20 hindsight.
Okay.
We filmed a lot of different things. We filmed Aunt Beast. But, you know, you want the best movie. And so sometimes when there are things that are left on the cutting room floor, it was because it was to make the best movie.
Okay.
And so I was really, you know, pleased with that. Yeah.
In the bonus section that we just watched, I think you were talking about Madeline's favorite line was like
an equal.
Referencing that, and because you were friends with her, how do you think she would feel about having such a diverse and inclusive cast?
Oh, I think she would love that. I think Madeline would be so proud. And I'm very, very close to Madeline's granddaughter, Charlotte Jones-Voiklis. And Charlotte and I talk about this a lot because we're both asked that question. You know, bottom line, how could anyone not be so appreciative of writing something over 50 years ago that continues to mean so much, and that a studio such as Disney and filmmakers like Ava DuVernay and Jennifer Lee and Jim Whittaker would wish to give so much time and energy to bring her story to the screen. So, you know, and I think that Madeline was at that place in life where you have to let it go. You know, it belongs, doesn't belong to her anymore. It belongs to, you know, everybody else. So I'm sure she would have loved the idea that Ava wished to make a movie based on her book.
Catherine, I see a lot of magical realism in this movie, and I haven't read the book, but what you say is a lot of this type of writing that many Latin American writers do in that time, started in that time, Gabriel García Márquez or other writers. Did you ever feel tempted to probably produce another type of book like this with such a magical story in it? Or
always. You know, I mean, I think, you know, when Madeline won the Newbery Award in 1963, she read her speech because it's really quite lovely. But she talks about the universal language of children's stories. You know, they rise above all cultures, all religions. Usually they deal with such deep truths about growing up, sadness, joy, love. And I think I love the fantastical because it's just a different world to go into to see your reality. Sometimes it's very hard to see the world that you're living in and what's really happening, but you go into a new world. That's why if you go and set something in Downton Abbey back in, you know, the turn of the century, or you go at Outlander, or you go to Game of Thrones, it's all fantasy, it's all magical, because there are great stories to tell us more about who we are right now. And actually, someone I once asked me, you know, why do they go to Uriel? Why do they have to go to Uriel? And it's like, oh my gosh, because they take them to Uriel to see the dark thing that they cannot see on Earth, because they want them to see, have a new perspective and a new dimension to see the reality in which they live in. And that's why I think I love magical stories so much, is because I think it helps us see our reality, funny enough, better than maybe some real dramatic stories.
What was the most interesting part of producing the movie for you? Or which scene, or which part of the whole process was the most interesting for you?
I think the greatest challenge and the most rewarding was learning what collaboration is about. Because, you know, for a very long time, I had a certain movie in my head, and I had worked on it with many writers and different executives for a long time. So there was a certain, you know, idea that I had, and that it was just really important to learn how to collaborate and to learn how to listen and learn from others. And, you know, I'm really thankful for Jennifer and Ava to kind of help me see it from a different point of view. I thought that was very important. I was really happy about that.
In seeing the movie and seeing the story, acted out in real life, did it make you think about any part of the book differently? Like when you saw it in real life, were you like, oh, I never thought of that part of the story in that way?
Well, it's funny you should ask. Yeah, I'm sure it did. But I'll tell you what it really did. You know, I spent a good amount of time with Madeline at her home in Crosswicks. And her home in Crosswicks is the model for the Murray home in the book. So the very first time that I went to meet with Madeline at her home, first thing she did was to take me to Meg's attic bedroom. And I saw the wide wooden floorboards, and I saw the ping pong table, and I saw the doll's house, and I saw everything that is in, and I sat on the brass bed and looked out the window down to see the trees lashing in the wind. And so on set, sometimes I had a very surreal experience, like I had lived this story, right? Yeah. Madeline was my Mrs. What's It, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Which. I had been inside the real Murray home. And so being on the set watching it, I was struck by how surreal it felt. And exciting, you know, but yeah. It did feel surreal, especially in the kitchen, because I spent a lot of time with Madeline in the kitchen at the house in Crosswicks. And so it was just really cool to be there and yet at the same time have that experience I had with her in the Murray home.
That's so awesome.
You know, I'm curious, Catherine, because so much is made about Meg in the book and Meg's love, Meg's journey, but an equally important journey that drives her and her heart is Charles Wallace. So I'm curious about your connection with the character of Charles Wallace and the strength that he brings to this dynamic in the film.
Asked by someone who truly knows A Wrinkle in Time. Because you are so right. And, you know, Charles Wallace is this fantastic character. And interestingly enough, there are a lot of people that read that book and identify with Charles Wallace. And Madeline was, I have to say, I thought very brilliant in describing him. This young boy is new, different, you know, in essence, because every generation thinks they're new, different in essence. And so Charles Wallace really, truly represented something new. And I have to tell you, Madeline used to always say that she is Meg. Well, I'm here to tell you, she was Charles Wallace. And she was definitely something new. And I think this was an incredible spiritual journey for her to try to figure out who am I, where am I, where are we going? And I think in the writing of it, she was part Meg and she was part Charles Wallace. And ultimately, she'll say her Calvin was her husband, Hugh. But Charles Wallace was so important to it. And I have to say, unfortunately, we did not have a very two moving scenes with Charles Wallace. One is on Uriel, when they are flying on the Centaur, the leaf in the movie, where he can translate what he's hearing, which immediately, when you're in the book, you immediately then understand, whoa, this kid is not normal, you know, because the other two cannot translate what's going on. And I was sorry that we had to lose that. And the other was on Kamazots, in the encounter with the man with red eyes, the prime coordinator, Charles Wallace makes the choice to go in because he loves his father too. And he is willing to sacrifice in order to save him. And that was really, really important, and we just, for whatever reason, we couldn't have it. And the other thing about Charles Wallace, I read once where some writer thought, well, you know, Wrinkle in Time, you know, was just, it didn't work as a book. And part of the reason why was that once father was found, the story didn't have any place to go. The climax was over. And I remember reading that and thinking, oh, this guy doesn't understand this story at all. Because you guys know the term MacGuffin? In literary terms, it's like, you know, something that triggers the story, but it's not really what the story is about. This story really isn't about a daughter and a father. The story is really about, you know, her coming into her own, but also how much she loves her brother. And it's really ultimately the story between a brother and a sister. And Charles Wallace is the character that helps Meg become who she is. You know, she goes from fearful to fearless. And Charles Wallace is the one that's playing this role to move her there. So, yes, Charles Wallace was equally important. Anything else?
One last question. The last question.
Okay. What would happen with all those fabulous sets that were built for this movie?
You know, I can't tell you that specifically, the final answer. I think a lot of them were dismantled, you know.
Wow. And those costumes.
Pardon?
The costumes.
Oh, I think those costumes, were they beautiful? Oh, they were so great. They were so wonderful. But it was so funny to watch, particularly Oprah in one of them walk. That's very difficult.
Very binding out of all of them.
But no, they definitely transformed these actresses into otherworldly creatures.
What is the background of Paco Delgado?
I'm sorry?
What's the background of
Paco? Well, he what was it called? Les Miserables, and he did The Danish Girl, and he has worked a lot with Tom Hooper, the director Tom Hooper, and he is just, he has this beautiful, this brilliance of the fantastical. And I think, you know, Ava's goal was to create this fantastic, otherworldly look for these ladies. And I think their collaboration was just wonderful. I think he really delivered on it.
I want one.
There was one Boldero.